This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
One unpredictable instability is the new normal. Roughly half of the world's currently stable countries are at some risk of instability over the next 2 years.
Is it disgraceful that the intelligence agencies allowed any information that turned out to be so false and fake out?
There is so much fake news in the U.S. right now, they don't need to create manipulated truths, they can just ride them.
But Robert...
And that's something that Nazi Germany would have done and did do. I think it's a disgrace.
Hello and welcome to TrumpCast. I'm Virginia Heffernan. So we have an atypical and thrilling guest on the show today, and I feel very, very comfortable and relaxed right now on my birthday, just talking to one of my hometown pals. We used to party just vaping and taking shrooms in an unfinished half-built house in New Hampshire in the 80s, playing Aerosmith. And that's right, he's General James Clapper, the former director of national intelligence under President Barack Obama. Okay, I'm terrified. I saw Full Metal Jacket and Private Benjamin. I know how talking to generals when you hardly know how to salute or stand in line can go down. But the truth is, I tore through General Clapper's new book, Facts and Fears, Hard Truths from a Life in Intelligence, which is, I'm not kidding, one of the best chronicles of our troubled times, which puts the Russian cyber attacks in the context of Clapper's lifetime spent outsmarting Soviets and then Russians at spycraft. So I'm going to try to stand up straight and not mention shrooms. And just for today, we're also going to put aside the Mar-a-Lago shadow cabinet running the VA and also how our president may be changing the landscape of the 2018 midterms. You know, we're also going to have to shelve the harrowing spectacle of sweaty, adulterous thief Rick Gates on the witness stand. And that means we can't really talk about the amazing Art Lean court drawings of Gates and Paul Manafort. Art Lean, A-R-T-L-I-E-N, is the court artist. What a great name for a court artist. Like, if Manafort collected art, he would have an Art Lean on his collection. See what I'm saying? I'm sure we'll visit all those stories before long on TrumpCast, but today we're going for the wide-angle view with General James Clapper. I'll be back with him in just a minute.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Joining me from Slate's DC studio is General James Clapper. He served as the 4th Director of National Intelligence and Senior Intelligence Advisor to President Barack Obama from 2010 to 2017. He has a book out called Facts and Fear, Hard Truths from a Life in Intelligence. And most importantly, he's a guest on today's show. General Clapper, thanks for joining us on TrumpCast.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
So I have never read a book, I realize, about spycraft that's not written by John le Carré. So it's very, I really devoured Facts and Fears, your book about a life in intelligence. I guess I want to start sort of where the book starts, which is your lifespan essentially spans the history of the Soviet threat and the history of a certain kind of intelligence gathering on the part of the U.S. and its allies.
Yeah, that's true. I actually grew up, I guess, a fledgling Cold War warrior. My dad was serving as a signal intelligence officer himself, collecting against the Warsaw Pact. So I got to know some of the soldiers that worked for my dad because the age difference wasn't all that great. I was 17 or 18 years old, and and just living in that environment of the Cold War and the huge American military presence in Germany, and that, I think, at an early age enlightened me, if you will. The year after I graduated from high school, from Nuremberg American High School, I went to the University of Maryland at Munich. And my roommate and I, incident I recount in the book, took the train to through East Germany to Berlin. And it was quite eye-opening at a relatively young age to see up close and personal just what the Soviet threat meant, you know, the stark contrast between East Berlin and West Berlin. And that really made an indelible impression on me.
So not to put words in your mouth, but I can imagine you could hardly foresee an America that was closely aligned with a Soviet-like dictator in the form of Vladimir Putin, or at least our executive branch is looking increasingly like that way. How did it register with you that we had this kind of president on our hands, or at least this kind of candidate on our hands?
Actually, this began before the election. As you know, from starting, I guess, in 2015, but particularly in the summer and fall of 2016, as we the intelligence community gained more and more insight and understanding about the magnitude of what the Russians were doing to interfere in the election, and in fact trying to influence it, the outcome of it in favor of one candidate in the disfavor of the other. And as I've said publicly, that in my 50 plus years in intelligence, I've seen a lot of bad stuff, but I don't think anything that disturbed me as much as watching what the Russians were doing, which frankly was part of the motivation for actually writing the book.
The book is propulsive, partly because you know that it's you start to understand the context that's going into how things come out beginning in 2015. So you, in 2015, at the Worldwide Threat Assessment hearing before the Senate and Armed Services Committee, you said unpredictable instability is the new normal, 2015. Half the world's countries, currently stable countries, are at the risk of some instability over the next 2 years, right, in 2015. When you were reading that statement, did you have a sense that America itself was at risk of becoming one of those politically unstable countries?
I don't know that at the time I did, but regrettably, using the metrics and measures that the intelligence community uses to gauge instability in other countries, to some extent, we exhibit some of that. Now, that wasn't, I don't think, on my mind in 2015, but certainly since then, I think that's a worrisome concern, certainly for me anyway.
So you were, I think, right around the time, maybe just months before, the Sony was beset by this North Korea hack. And I know that episode was sort of formative for people learning about the state of play in cyber warfare. What would you tell Trump today about dealing with North Korea, about Kim Jong-un and the DPRK? Not that he would listen.
Listen. Well, one of the things that struck me when I went to North Korea in 2014 to secure the release of two of our citizens was North Koreans are stuck on their narrative and we are stuck on ours, which at the time was you must denuclearize before we'll talk to you, which was a non-starter, I learned firsthand. And the only, and given the relationship, the only partner that could change that narrative was us. So I thought actually it was a good idea for the president to meet with Kim Jong-un. I do think, though, regrettably, he squandered the leverage he had, the considerable leverage he had, just by virtue of agreeing to meet, which was a huge want of the North Koreans going back to Kim Jong-un's grandfather, Kim Il-sung. Mm-hmm. So I don't think he extracted or used the leverage he had. And I thought gratuitously agreeing to give up the so-called war games was a big mistake. It was unnecessary because the North Koreans understand exactly what that war game is all about that we do annually with our Republic of Korea allies. And it's a defensive exercise, and the North Koreans know that. So,
I mean, what's it like for you as an American citizen, you know, as military, as ex-intelligence, to sit and watch the displays with Kim Jong-un and then with Vladimir Putin of our president? I mean, I mean, what is it?
Well, it's amazing to me. It's amazing to me because it's incomprehensible that we berate our traditional, historical, closest allies, starting with Canada and Mexico, our two closest allies geographically, not to mention the likes of the UK or France or Germany or others. And at the same time, we seem to heap praise on and pay great deference to despots, autocrats like Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un. And I just thought it was incredible to watch the new press conference in Helsinki and the president's deference to Vladimir Putin and his denials of meddling in our election, which is incredible given the just overwhelming evidence. We had very, very good high confidence and intelligence that what the Russians were doing. There's just no doubt about it. It wasn't China. It wasn't the 400-pound guy in his bed in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. It was the Russians. Mm-hmm. And all that evidence has been presented to him, and it's been emphasized by his own appointees who succeeded me and others that served in the last administration. So it's just unthinkable to me.
So in sort of tracking how abnormal the current administration is, maybe you can tell us, when you were serving under Obama, what is it like presenting intelligence findings to a sane and stable president?
Well,
as opposed to one who rejects them.
Yeah, in President Obama's case, whatever else you may think about him, one of the things he was staunch about and emphasized to me and others in the intelligence committee repeatedly, that he always wanted the straight facts as we saw them. There were occasions where some of his advisors perhaps weren't so wild about that, but he always wanted the unvarnished truth from intelligence. So that's a very positive and constructive atmosphere in which to work. And so working for him under that circumstance was superb.
So one of the things you did with Obama was help build the philosophical, factual groundwork for the Iran deal. What were those days like for you when the U.S. was negotiating that deal?
Well, we sort of had our head down trying to provide as much insight as we could into, you know, what the Iranians were thinking and what their intentions were throughout the negotiation. That was kind of our role. I agreed with what we did. I thought the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was a good thing. You know, for me, it was a fairly simple proposition. Which would you rather have, a state-sponsored terrorism with a nuclear weapons capability or a state-sponsored terrorism without a nuclear weapons capability?
It seems simple to me.
I go ahead and pick the latter option.
Yep.
The agreement wasn't perfect, but the Iranians have abided by it, and they've allowed unprecedented monitoring and surveillance capabilities in their country. And so to me, I always considered that this was just a start, and this is a way to gain influence and leverage with the Iranians to get at some of the other nefarious behavior, which we certainly recognized as well. But we thought the most important thing was to take the most serious threat off the table, which was a developing nuclear weapons capability, which the JCPOA did.
So we now Trump has axed the deal or backed out of it. And what is Trump missing about that deal?
Well, yeah, I don't quite get the logic. What Trump has said is he wants a, quote, better deal. Mm-hmm. Presumably, the better deal means a comprehensive reform of all of Iran's nefarious behavior, not only their nuclear activity, but their nefarious regional activity, their support of the Houthis in Yemen, their support of Hezbollah, et cetera, et cetera. Yet we're going to bring that about by exerting a whole lot less leverage than we had just to change one aspect of their bad behavior. So I don't get the logic of how we're going to induce the Iranians to go for a comprehensive deal, particularly when we're trying to only do it coercively.
You don't think that bluster and tweets are going to work as, you know, he can
They have imposed sanctions, which to a certain extent will put more pressure on Iran. It also has the effect of playing to the hardliner narrative in Iran. There's a big upheaval going on in Iran. There's lots of resentment about the corruption of the regime and the poor economy and all that. But what the hardliners will do is use our withdrawal, our abrogation of the JCPOA as kind of a see we told you so sort of thing, and strengthen their argument for being more isolated and continuing the nefarious activities in the region.
We just got the Department of Justice indictments of the GRU officers, the Russian military intelligence officers responsible for much of the, or as much as we know, as much as the public knows of the cyber attacks during the 2016 election. What did you make of that document? I mean, it's a justice document. It's Mueller's team, obviously. Is it stuff you already knew? I mean, as you know, it struck those of us who don't know this field as incredibly comprehensive.
Yes, it was, and very specific. And I don't think there's any doubt at all about who did this. And I think that indictment gives you some insight into the fidelity of the information that the intelligence community gathered, and just one aspect of it that shows how detailed and specific our insight into what the Russians did. It also served, in my view, along with the earlier indictment on the Internet Research Agency and its people, it served to validate the findings of the intelligence community assessment that we mm-hmm. produced mm-hmm. In January of 2017. So I hope thinking Americans will have read both those indictments as insight into the magnitude and the sophistication of what the Russians did.
Even before that, you had also talked about a particular cyber threat, the one known as spear phishing, which was used by the GRU agents in 2016. You talked about steps that cyber experts and our institutions could take to protect themselves. What steps do you think our institutions need to take now to protect themselves? And we haven't referred to the Iranian attacks that the Department of Justice just addressed.
Well, I'll tell you, my experience is the most important thing to do is to educate people. I will tell you, my own staff in the intelligence community, we had a training program to try to alert people, to train them to recognize spear phishing attempts, because spear phishing continues to be probably the most popular technique used by neither nation states or non-nation state entities, hacktivists, criminals, whatever, to gain access to networks of interest. Mm-hmm. And the thing you have to do is to educate people to recognize sphere phishing and don't open emails that you're not sure about the source, and particularly attachments, and because that's how adversaries, whoever they are, will gain access and plant malware.
I was an aspiring PhD student in the days of the Unabomber, and we were heavily instructed about what to do with packages that came. You know, he was targeting academics, and what to do with packages that came into our little cubby boxes that seemed like they might have wires or bombs in them. But academics, you know, according to the Iranian indictments, have been widely targeted. I even was phished by a Turkish, seemingly a Turkish group on Twitter. I fell for it. You know, what seems so surprising about this time is that the IRA and to some extent the GRU in staging material targeted at civilians, targeted at changing minds, their targets are all of us, everyone who uses the internet.
And exactly.
And people don't have this kind of acute understanding of counterintelligence that you do.
Well, I don't know. There is no silver bullet here. And I think that the problem is that, the technology of today, the internet and the great things it does is inherently insecure. Unfortunately, the founding fathers and mothers didn't consider security when the internet was first invented, back in the 70s or whenever it was. And so if you have a connection with the internet at all, and this applies to everybody, individuals, corporate entities, government institutions, if you have a connection with the internet, you have inherently a security vulnerability, and you have to be aware of it. It's so much a part of our lives that every day that it's hard to keep your mind on the potential security implications of being on the internet. By the way, this also, I think, illustrates the huge challenge that the intelligence community has, notably the National Security Agency and the FBI, where you have, as you indicated, millions and millions, hundreds of millions of people conducting billions of innocent transactions every day. But all mixed among those innocent transactions are nefarious people conducting nefarious transactions. And so the challenge for the intelligence community and law enforcement community is, you know, trying to pick out the nefarious actors, which are all among the innocent people, mm-hmm. without infringing on anyone's civil liberties and privacy, which is a real challenge.
So, in other times, in more sort of legible, understandable times, we would have probably a statement from the president saying what these particular cyber attacks have done, what citizens ought to expect, how they might comport themselves or stay somewhat safer on the internet, and what measures are being taken to protect our privacy with the big tech companies and the intelligence community. We don't have anyone doing that. And that's partly because Trump has set up antagonism between the intelligence community and the White House. Not only that, but intelligence community and Republicans generally. And so you can't say a word about this without being seen as throwing in with some partisan issue.
Well, I thought the recent statements made by the leaders of the national security team in the White House press room were very compelling. I thought they were all genuine and sincere, and they sounded in one way or another rang the bell for vigilance on the part of citizens and underlined and reinforced the threat posed by adversaries, most notably Russia. And unfortunately, the president undercut that just within a matter of hours at one of his rallies by saying it was all a hoax. Now, he may have met, the investigation of him as a hoax, but the way it came across, and of course, as usual, people had to come along and clean up the broken China. And it's good that everybody's each is in their own lanes doing their own thing, whether it's Homeland Security or the FBI or NSA or anybody else. But what's missing here, this isn't just an intergovernmental thing. This is an inter-society thing. And only the commander-in-chief, I think, can galvanize a sense of urgency, not only across the government, but across the public, about the threat that the Russians particularly pose and their intent to undermine our fundamental system.
I know you. I don't want to keep you too long, sir, but one last question. So has there ever been a president in your father's time in intelligence, in your own time in intelligence, that has separated himself so decisively from the intelligence community of his own United States? I mean, even before his inauguration, Trump compared the intelligence community to Nazis. It's as though they are the enemy, and not Russia.
Yes, it's this whole deep state narrative. Then President-elect Trump did refer to us as Nazis, and which occasioned my calling him. I felt a sense of duty and obligation to the men and women of the intelligence community to protest as respectfully as I could his characterization of the intelligence community as Nazis, which is so far off base and so inappropriate and so unfair. And I tried to convey to him that he was inheriting a national treasure in the form of the intelligence community, which was committed to serving him and every president with the best information possible to help enlighten the very tough decisions he'd have to make.
So how does this come out? How do you see it ending? I mean, how do you, like, on the extreme, maybe you can give me a worst case, best case. I mean, do we have something, do we have ground war to fear? Do we have nuclear war to fear? Or just simply something more closer to the destabilization of our institutions, which we've already seen?
Well, that of course, is a great question. There are ways to empirically measure a nation state's resilience. And, you know, we have all those characteristics in abundance. And our institutions have certainly taken some hits. The assaults on an independent judiciary and an independent and free press come to mind as examples. But by and large, overall, I think, we've survived pretty well. The country has survived previous traumas, you know, civil war, and then a trauma I lived through myself, the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And eventually we emerge the better and the stronger for it. And I hope that's what happens here.
General, I commend you on your book, Facts and Fears, Hard Truths from a Life in Intelligence. It's as riveting as Le Carre, I have to say, listeners. Thanks also so much for being here.
Well, thanks so much for having me, and thanks for giving the book a good read.
And that's it for today's show. We always want to know what you think of the show. So be sure to follow and tweet at us at RealTrumpCast. It's the easiest way to find out what we're up to and what we'll be up to in the coming days, weeks, months, years of this administration. Anyway, that's at RealTrumpCast. Our show was produced today by Jason DeLeon with the help of Danielle Hewitt down in Slate's office in D.C. Thank you, Danielle. And I'm Virginia Heffernan. Thanks for listening to TrumpCast.